This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with historian Paul LeBlanc on the tremendous socialist victory of Zoran Mamdani in the race for mayor in New York City on November 4th.
Does the Mamdani victory in New York portend a rollback of the authoritarian and fascist forces now governing America? We also look at the critical response and the lawsuit passed against the recent education code change in California, allowing teachers to be monitored and disciplined in regards to what they teach about Israel and Palestine. We talk with returning guest Professor Emeritus Marjorie Cohn about AB 715 and her recent article addressing the lawsuit brought against state leaders on behalf of California public school teachers and parents of students.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
34-year-old Zoran Mamdani, an immigrant from Uganda, a Muslim and a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, won in an overwhelming victory in New York City's primary in September and then won the mayoral race in New York City on November 4th. His team of some 100,000 door knockers, canvassers, and phone bankers swept the charismatic Mamdani into first place over the former governor and mainline Democrat Andrew Cuomo. Cuomo was supported financially and politically by 28 different billionaires, Wall Street, and the real estate interests. The tops of the Democratic Party refused to endorse Zoran, even after Mamdani won the Democratic primary, and then even after he won the mayoral race. Trump smeared Zoran as a, quote, lunatic communist and has already cut off $18 billion of federal funding for the state of New York. The victory of Mamdani and the magnificent movement behind him came after the No Kings demonstrations attended by millions across the country. It is the most significant development so far in the fight back against the oligarchs, authoritarians, and fascist forces in the USA. The Mamdani success has changed the relationship of forces between the American people and their rulers like nothing we have ever seen since the huge rebellion against the Vietnam War in 1968. What are the implications for New York City and beyond? For the growth and influence of socialist ideas, and for the DSA. We speak today with returning guest historian Paul LeBlanc, professor emeritus of history at La Roche University in Pittsburgh, and an active member of the Pittsburgh chapter of the DSA. He's the author of many books on socialism and labor history, and most recently a contributor to A User's Guide to the DSA, with an article entitled An Effective Force for Socialism. Professor Paul LeBlanc, welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thanks, Michael. It's really good to be back.
Well, it's really good to have you, Paul. Paul, you've been an active leftist for six decades. Please give us a sketch of your political development and what you made you a socialist.
Well, let's see. I've got 27 minutes before this show is over. So this is going to take a while. So let me do a succinct summary. One thing is that my parents and other members of my family were part of the trade union movement and were labor and left-wing activists. And that influenced me profoundly. And then, of course, as I was starting to go through my teenage years, there was the Cuban Revolution, there was the Civil Rights Movement, there was the Vietnam War that were all unfolding. And so that influenced me, and I was able to be involved in the anti-war movement and a little bit the Civil Rights Movement, and that influenced me very much. And I considered myself part of the New Left, and I was a member of Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, for a number of years, and then that collapsed. And by the time it collapsed, I was already a socialist, a conscious socialist, and felt that there was a need for something better than what SDS was able to be. And I was drawn to the Socialist Workers' Party and to the Trotskyist tradition, and was, you know, active in that for about 10 years. That organization unfortunately went bad, and then I was involved in various fragments in the wake of that development, including especially Solidarity. I then became part of the International Socialist Organization, which for a time had a couple thousand members. Then that collapsed. And so most recently I've been involved in a fragment of that group called Tempest, the Tempest Collective. I've also rejoined Solidarity because I'm in basic agreement with that. But then most recently I joined and became active in Democratic Socialists of America. So those are the three groups that I'm part of now. I see this whole development as a process. We need a revolutionary socialist organization that has a mass base that doesn't exist yet. But it seems to me some of the elements that could constitute such an organization and such a movement are in the process of evolving. And I'd like to be part of that and help out with that as best I can.
Mm-hmm. What was it, though, that drew you now more recently into the Democratic Socialists of America, Paul?
Well, as I said a moment ago, I see DSA as part of that process. And it is certainly the biggest of the organizations. It's very diverse, very open, with a lot of relatively young activists in it. It's alive. It's contradictory, but it's an important element, it seems to me, in the political chemistry can result in a mass socialist movement. So I want to be part of that. I want to connect with the younger comrades who are doing that or trying to do that kind of thing.
Paul, tell us about the DSA. What does it stand for? Are there various factions inside of the DSA? What are their members doing? What's their size? What percentage of the membership is active, and what percentage is on paper only? Can you give us a feeling for this, and is it growing?
Yes. Those are excellent questions. DSA is a very sort of elastic organization. It contains many different elements, many different currents and parts. What does it stand for? Well, it stands for socialism, as best as the members can understand what that means. And there are different interpretations, different understandings of it. And this is reflected also in how the thinking of members on how to get from the capitalist present, which we're all critical of, to the hoped-for socialist future, and that helps to generate different factions inside of DSA. So there are various factions, and DSA is a very open kind of organization, so there's room for that kind of disagreement, and at the same time, those factions, to a significant degree, are able to work together. Its size, and it is growing, its size until recently was like around 80,000, and now I think it's up to 100,000, or it's getting close to 100,000. So there is tremendous growth now. But it's an important question also, what percentage of the membership is active? I would judge, and I'm not alone in judging this, that only 10% are active. The rest are on paper, you know, members, they're supporting, they're paying dues, but they are not coming to meetings. So 10%, let's take that for a moment. There are about 700 members on paper in Pittsburgh, where I live. And so that means that coming to a membership meeting are about, you know, 50 to 70 people, which is very substantial. It is, even with the active membership, it is far bigger than anything else around. So that gives some sense of the answer to the questions that you were asking, Michael.
You mentioned in the course of that answer, Paul, the certain differences, and they're argued out within the organization. Some members, for example, the DSA, I understand, say they're for a Scandinavian model, whereas others say they cannot coexist with a capitalist class and they want to replace them. Can you talk to us a bit about the differences in these perspectives within the organization?
Sure. And I need to preface it by emphasizing I'm not a member of any of the particular caucuses. Can give you some limited sense of things. The belief in the Scandinavian model of, I think the majority of members of DSA don't see socialism existing in Norway or Denmark or Sweden or the other Scandinavian countries. There is a tradition. The person, the key founder of DSA, is the late Michael Harrington, who was close to Willy Brandt in Germany and Olof Palme in Sweden. That model of socialism, so-called, is something that he promoted. But the followers of Harrington now constitute a very small caucus, and they're not very influential. There are many more who have a clearer definition of socialism and feel that ultimately we cannot coexist with the capitalist class. They need to be replaced by the working class in terms of who is calling the shots in our economy and in our society. And yet there are differences. But the differences are not on so much on what would socialism look like, but what is the best way to get there and how can we get there and how quickly can we move and how, you know, what kind of process needs to take place. So, for example, there are some who continue to adhere to some element of Michael Harrington's old perspective of working in and through the Democratic Party. But there is a greater sharpness around that than there used to be. And not everyone is in agreement either. There are some who want, I think there's general agreement. It would be good to have a mass working class socialist party, a labor party, something other than the Democratic Party. But there are differences on how quickly it would be possible to achieve that and what's the best pathway to achieving that. So those are some of the differences that currently exist in the organization.
Thank you.
What was your reaction to the Mamdani victory?
Initially, I was not even aware, somebody's running, some guy named Mamdani is running for mayor of New York. He doesn't have a chance, was my initial thought. And then my partner, Nancy, pointed out what I was not following, which is he has a very good chance, and then he won. And it was an exciting, exhilarating reality. And in particular, because he is a member, an active member of DSA, he is a conscious socialist, and his program, I think, reflects that. And he is well connected with the organization so that it's not just this guy who got an endorsement from DSA who won an election. This is a socialist who won the election, a member of DSA, and with, I think, a pretty good program. So I was very excited. It wasn't just me. I mean, the people that I know around the country, but certainly in Pittsburgh, people on the left, on the whole, had a similar reaction.
I wonder, how do you see the Mamdani victory with respect today, to the resistance to the fascist forces in America?
Well, I think that there are a couple of things to be said. One is the Mamdani victory doesn't take place, obviously, in a vacuum. So it comes in the wake of the biggest demonstrations, or some of the biggest demonstrations in the history of our country, against the Trump regime and against what it represents, and not only the right-wing, supranationalist, bigoted, racist, and fascist-oriented policies, but these demonstrations have indicated a consciousness among a growing section of the U.S. working class, because the millions of people who were involved in the demonstrations, most of them are part of the working class one way or another. Whether they have a blue collar or a white collar, they sell their ability to work for a paycheck. These massive demonstrations, which were a repudiation of Trumpism in all of its awfulness, this was the context within which the Mamdani campaign won. So it seems to me that it's a resistance. It is a resistance and a form of effective resistance to right-wing, reactionary, and fascist-oriented forces in the U.S. This is the way for us to go. This is the way for us to defeat that. Now, that there's no guarantee that we will be successful, but I see the Mamdani victory as having a potential for going in that direction. And also it has a potential for helping to build a mass socialist consciousness and a mass socialist movement in this country.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my ex-law partner, Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with Paul LeBlanc about the DSA and the victory of Zohran Mamdani in the recent election for mayor in New York City. Paul, do you think the Democratic Party can be reformed and made into an organization that fights fascism?
That's an excellent question, an important question. And it is one of the differences that exists in DSA. There are members of DSA who would answer, yes, it can be reformed. It can be made into an organization that fights fascism and fights the right wing effectively. I don't think so. And there are many who do not think so. So the use of the Democratic Party ballot line has been used by Mamdani and others to put socialism and socialist ideas and a socialist reform agenda before large numbers of people. And Mamdani, I think, made very effective use of that. But at the same time, there is, I think, a questionable line of thought that may affect many in and around the Mamdani campaign, that this is part of turning the Democratic Party into the kind of organization that we need. It is controlled in multiple ways by big-time capitalists and pro-capitalists, and I don't think that's going to change. So at a certain point, that will become clear, I'm hoping, to a majority of people in DSA and in the country, and then we'll build something, the kind of organization that we need.
In fact, Paul, isn't the case that some people think the Democratic Party has been complicit historically and currently in the rise of fascism, American style? Your thoughts on that?
I that is how I see it. That is absolutely the case. And in more than one way, there are some big-time capitalists who would prefer Trump to Mamdani, for example, and would be prepared to make alliances with Trump. In fact, I mean, Trump was once upon a time part of the billionaire strata that had its foot in the Democratic Party. Some of those people are still around and they still have an influence. But also, because the Democratic Party consistently needs to pull its punches, it cannot put forward a consistent socialist analysis and socialist alternative to capitalism. That mean, and as Nancy Pelosi once said, we're a capitalist party. That's not going to change. And I think it's not going to change. So that means that they are not able to provide the solutions. They can provide rhetoric, empty rhetoric, but growing numbers of people have become disillusioned with that and are looking for alternatives because there are a number of crises developing in our society thanks to capitalism. And the Democrats don't have an alternative, so people are looking around for an alternative, and Trump claimed to represent an alternative. And there are people even worse than Trump I mean, I think that Trump is more like a tin-pot dictator than a highly developed fascist. But there are highly developed fascists also who claim to be representing an alternative to the crises we face. To the extent that the Democratic Party is leading the fight against that, it will be ineffective and it will result in the growth of the right wing and the growth of fascism. So I think in more than one way, it has been historically complicit, as you put it, in the rise of fascist developments in the U.S.
Paul LeBlanc, you're friendly too, and you have many friends among several of the caucuses in the left and the center left of the DSA. These include Bread and Roses, Reform and Revolution, the Marxist Unity Group, and the Communist Caucus. Can you tell us about these various caucuses, please?
I can tell you a little bit, but I want to reemphasize something I said before, which is I'm not a member of any of these caucuses, and so that limits the kind of information that I have. Bread and Roses contains some people who are in, a few people who are in, I'm not a member of Bread and Roses, but there are some members of Solidarity who are, and there are former members of Solidarity who are, and so I have some sense of them. They have, I think, a perspective that is somewhat similar to the kinds of things that I've been saying, although I think there's a certain diversity in Bread and Roses. Reform and Revolution, also, I think some of the things I've been saying are consistent with what some of them believe. And at the same time, there are divisions that I know about for sure in Reform and Revolution. A couple of people who are on one side of that division recently put out a very useful book called A User's Guide to DSA. It contains the perspectives and presentations of 20-some or 20 and more representatives and spokespeople of DSA and of the different caucuses and currents in DSA. So that is a valuable tool. The Marxist Unity Group, I have spoken on the same platform with some of them. I think there's a rigidity in that group that I'm not totally comfortable with. And then there's the Communist Caucus, and that contains a few people who are in the Pittsburgh branch of DSA. And they are very, very good and seem to me to be focused on helping to strengthen the branch and to promote mass action and organizing among workers, among renters, you know, on the housing issue and so forth. And I like what they're doing. I like their approach. So that gives some sense of those particular caucuses. There are some that are consider themselves much further to the left. There is a so-called Socialist Majority Caucus that is very committed to working in the Democratic Party, and it used to be the dominant caucus in DSA, but that's no longer the case. So things are, there's ebb and flow and development within the organization itself. Maybe that gives some sense of what the reality is that you're asking about.
Now, going back to the Mondami victory again in the mayoral race, he got 1 million votes and indeed approximately 100,000 people mobilized to get those votes. They phone banked, they knocked on doors, they canvassed and what have you. Do these people have a role now that the election has been won? And if yes, what is that role?
Yeah, I think they have a decisive role. The election is won, but the struggle has just begun. The Democratic Party establishment, along with the Republican Party establishment, along with the billionaires, the capitalist class, all of them are opposed to even the reforms that Mamdani was calling for and that was central to his campaign and that people voted for. You know, free and fast buses, rent freeze, those kinds of things, these wonderful reforms that he's calling for. And is it going to cost some money? Well, then raise taxes on the rich. All of that's good stuff, and it's totally opposed by the so-called powers that be. And the only way it's going to be won is if the people who voted for him, voted for Mamdani, and who were active in getting out the vote for Mamdani, if they do not demobilize, but instead stay organized to organize support groups and coalitions to fight for the triumph of that program. Now it's essential that they move forward, that we move forward in that way.
Well, Paul, sadly, time has caught up with us. How can people follow your work both in and out of the DSA?
Well, I would urge people to check the internet, type in my name and then along with DSA, or you can check on DSA by typing that in and trying to follow various things that are being said by DSA members themselves. Now, also, I do a lot of writing. One of the online publications that I write for is called Communis. That is not communist, not communism, but Communis with no T or M. Type in my name and that, or type in my name and Lynx. And Lynx is a site in Australia. It's a global site for the recomposition of the international left. And I have a lot of stuff in there. So that would be a way to stay in touch with some of the stuff I'm thinking.
Well, and thank you so much. Thank you for your work, but thank you especially for joining us today on Law and Disorder.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Paul. I just have an aside. I don't think you're going to get this kind of discussion on any other radio show in America. We're very grateful to be able to talk with you, Paul. You take it easy.
Okay, thanks. You too.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Beginning January 1st of next year, teachers in California classrooms will have to look over their shoulders to avoid running afoul of an alarming new anti-Semitism law. On October 7th, despite widespread opposition from teachers' unions, civil rights groups, and education advocates, Governor Gavin Newsom signed AB 715. It amends the California Education Code to police what teachers can teach and what students can learn about Israel and Palestine. Under this law, teachers could be charged with unlawful discrimination and disciplined, and I quote, if they expose their students to ideas, information, and instructional materials that may be considered critical of the state of Israel and the philosophy of Zionism, close quote, according to a lawsuit filed on November 2nd by the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. With us today to analyze this new law is Marjorie Cohn. She is Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, Dean of the People's Academy of International Law, and former President of the National Lawyers Guild. She is a legal and political analyst who does media commentary and writes columns on Truthout and other outlets, and is a former host on Law and Disorder Radio. Her most recent book is Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Marjorie wrote an article that was published earlier this month in Truthout titled, Lawsuit Charges That California Law Illegally Muzzles Students and Teachers on Palestine, close quote. Well, Marjorie Cohn, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks for having me, Jim.
Marjorie, let's start off. We'll get to the plaintiffs later, and in terms of who the individual plaintiffs are, they have some interesting stories. But California has a dominant Democratic majority and their state legislature. But who is behind this law, and why did Governor Newsom sign it?
Well, that's a really good question, Jim. The Jewish Public Affairs Committee, or JPAC, was behind this bill, and they worked with the California Legislative Jewish Caucus to pass it. It went to a vote when it could have died in committee. One of the sponsors, California Senate President Pro Tem Mike McGuire, wants Israel lobby support when he runs for Congress in one of the newly drawn Proposition 50 districts, you know, the new districts that California just voted for. The diversity caucuses, African American Caucus, Asian Pacific Islander Caucus, and Latino Caucus, signed on as authors of the bill in hopes of getting ethnic studies funded, which did not happen. Governor Newsom signed the bill because he wants Israel lobby support when he runs for president. He's been tethered to the Israel lobby throughout his term as governor, and he was roasted on social media for acting clueless about APAC, American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is a very powerful pro-Zionist lobby in the U.S. and owns many people in Congress, I'm afraid. Members of the California state legislature are afraid that Assemblymember Jesse Gabriel, chair of the California Legislative Jewish Caucus, and California Senator Scott Weiner, they're afraid of them because they chair the budget committees and they are the face of the Israel lobby in the California state legislature. The short answer to your question, Jim, is the Israel lobby.
AB 715, the law we're talking about, it says it's designed to punish anti-Semitism. But how does that bill define, in fact, anti-Semitism?
Although it's ostensibly aimed at preventing anti-Semitism in the classroom, AB 17 doesn't define anti-Semitism. Rather, it instructs school districts to follow Joe Biden's U.S. national strategy to combat anti-Semitism. And that national strategy adopts the definition of anti-Semitism in the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, or the IHRA. The IHRA lists several examples of attitudes and speech that it defines as anti-Semitic, and I'll just give you a few examples. Accusing Jewish citizens of being more loyal to Israel or to the alleged priorities of Jews worldwide than to the interest of their own nations. Denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, that is, by claiming that the existence of the State of Israel is a racist endeavor. Applying double standards by requiring of Israel a behavior not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation, and I say democratic in quotes, because of course we know Israel is democratic only if you're Jewish. Drawing comparisons of contemporary Israeli policy to that of the Nazis. So those are some examples in this International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, IHRA. Both Biden's national security strategy and the IHRA conflate the criticism of Israel and Zionism with anti-Semitism. For example, they call it anti-Semitic to challenge Jewish people's right to a majority state in an area inhabited by an equal number of Palestinians. They require, quote, factually accurate, unquote, instruction, but they punish teachers professionally for making accurate statements, such as the fact that 750,000 Palestinians were forcibly expelled in 1948 during the creation of Israel in the Nakba. This conundrum places teachers in an untenable position.
Well, what are the constitutional provisions that the plaintiffs, and we will discuss those plaintiffs in a minute, what are the constitutional provisions that those plaintiffs are alleging are being violated by AB 715?
First, that it violates the First Amendment rights of teachers by being overbroad and viewpoint discriminatory, because it suggests that criticism of Israel and Zionism constitutes anti-Semitic discrimination. Second, that it violates the First Amendment right of students to receive information in the classroom. They'll be prevented from learning about different perspectives on Israel, Palestine, and the Middle East. And third, that it's unconstitutionally vague in violation of the Due Process Clause because it doesn't define the terms it purports to regulate. That opens the door to arbitrary and uneven enforcement. And thus, teachers can't know what they can or can't say, so they'll self-censor to avoid punishment.
Andrea Pritchett is the lead plaintiff in this lawsuit. Please tell us a bit about her and why she's so worried about AB 715.
First I want to say, Jim, that this lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California on behalf of California public school teachers and parents of students who seek to teach and learn about Palestine, Israel, and the Middle East. And the defendants named in this lawsuit, Pritchett versus Newsom, are Newsom, Attorney General Rob Bonta, and Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Thurmond. So the plaintiffs. First of all, Andrea Pritchett is a middle school history teacher at a public school in Berkeley, and all of this is in California, of course. She has many Palestinian students, and as part of a class project, they research and interview their parents about the events that led to their migration from Palestine. This entails discussion about settlements, colonization, and genocide. But there have already been two complaints against Pritchett, including when a student mentioned Israel and Palestine as examples of modern-day colonialism, and Pritchett responded that Israeli settlements in Palestine are an example of colonialism. Well, there was a long investigation, and the complaints against her were dismissed. But once AB 715 goes into effect on January 1st, Pritchett will be reluctant to teach about Israel and Palestine. Palestinian citizens of Israel don't have equal rights as Jewish citizens, and Palestinians in the West Bank have almost no rights at all under Israeli occupation. The international consensus is that Israel is illegally occupying Palestine. In fact, the International Court of Justice has actually held that. And that is factually accurate, but it could also be deemed anti-Semitic under this new law, as illustrated by Pritchett's previous experiences fielding complaints for saying similar things. And in light of what happened to her in the absence of AB 715, Pritchett said, quote, "I have almost no doubt that I would be a target under the new law."
Well, another plaintiff is Jonah Olson. Tell us about Jonah Olson and what his concerns are.
Well, Jonah Olson is a Jewish non-Zionist middle school science teacher at a public school in Adelanto, and he distinguishes between Zionism and Judaism. He believes that Zionism is a political ideology premised on the notion that Jews are superior to non-Jews and that they have the right to be a majority in a land that was inhabited primarily by Palestinians for hundreds of years and to occupy Palestine in order to maintain that majority. Olson's students work on science projects, and one project was designed to provide food in war-torn areas after the students saw photographs of moldy food that was delivered to Palestinians in Gaza. Another student focused in a project on distilling water after seeing images of a Palestinian woman in Gaza being forced to distill her own water due to lack of access to clean water. Well, once AB 715 is in effect, Olson says he will be afraid to allow discussion of food preservation and water distillation in Palestine because it could be considered anti-Semitic by pro-Israel individuals.
Well, and then another plaintiff is Dunia, I hope I pronounced that right, Hassan. What's her background and how does she think she's going to have to alter her assignments once AB 715 takes effect?
Dunia Hassan is a high school Spanish teacher at a public school in Santa Clara, and she was born to a Spanish mother and a Palestinian father. Her father came to Spain after being driven out of Haifa, Palestine, in 1948, when Israeli forces occupied his village and destroyed its homes and agriculture. She grew up hearing stories of her father's life in a refugee camp. After the October 2023 Hamas attack on Israel, her students began seeing horrific images of violence and destruction in Gaza and the West Bank. And a significant pro-Israel bias infiltrated her school district, according to this lawsuit. Hassan says that after AB 715 becomes effective, she would be hesitant to assign presentations called My Name, My Identity that she has assigned in the past.
What about Kauser Adewale?
Well, Kauser Adewale is a high school civics and economics public school teacher, also in Santa Clara, and she is a Muslim woman who wears a hijab. In December 2023, after her students asked about Palestine, she assigned a project to raise awareness of modern human rights violations. In March of 2024, someone filed a complaint against her, alleging that she had shown images and text that were horrifying, that's in quotes, and amounted to religious and/or ethnic discrimination. One was a photograph of the apartheid wall Israel had built in the West Bank to segregate Palestinians from Jewish settlers. And I should add here that the International Court of Justice found that that was illegal and ordered Israel to take it down, which they have not done. The investigation against Adewale found insufficient evidence of unlawful discrimination, but it concluded that she violated a rule requiring the teaching of diverse perspectives on controversial current events. Another complaint against Adewale followed a unit in which she showed a short video of an 87-year-old Holocaust survivor protesting Israel's actions in Gaza. And the survivor said that she had been inspired to make this protest by her Jewish ancestry. Well, the complaint against Adewale was not sustained, but she says that she has been, quote, left with a profound sense of disillusionment, unquote, because AB 715, quote, deprives students of the chance to think critically by punishing teachers who simply attempt to address the complex questions their students bring forward.
Now, at least one of the plaintiffs, I realize, is a student who goes by, at this point, JJ, just the initials. JJ is a student whose parents are Palestinian. Tell us about her and why she is a plaintiff in this lawsuit.
Yes, Jim. JJ is a 16-year-old high school student in Granite Bay. Both of her parents are Palestinian, which is central to her identity. As a Palestinian, she's aware that her mere existence is considered anti-Semitic or offensive to some because it requires an acknowledgement that the Palestinians lived in what is now Israel before creation of the modern state and recognition that her ancestors were expelled against their will to create a Jewish majority state, according to the lawsuit. For her speech and debate class, JJ discussed Palestine in extracurricular competitions, and she has had productive conversations with pro-Israel students. In JJ's words, AB 715 will discourage meaningful discussions that are necessary to learn about different perspectives so that common ground can be reached.
What about the plaintiff, Linda Corey Umel? She is a plaintiff representing her children. What should our listeners know about her?
Well, her children, YU and LU, they're juveniles, so they use their initials. They're attending and will attend, respectively, a public elementary school in San Mateo County. Linda Corey Umili is a Palestinian-American woman. For Arab Heritage Month, She did a presentation in her daughter's class where she wore traditional Palestinian attire. She served traditional Palestinian food and taught a traditional folk dance. The lawsuit states that the students and teacher loved the presentation and they all even ended up dancing at the end. But Kuri Umili is worried about giving a similar presentation once AB 715 goes into effect. She is afraid it could get her into trouble, as Palestinians are frequently accused of being anti-Semitic or offensive simply for being, since their existence naturally calls into question the idea that Israel was established in a land without people, according to the lawsuit.
And then we have, finally, Alice Finnan. She is a plaintiff representing, again, her daughter. What is her situation?
Yes, Alice Finnan is a plaintiff on behalf of GF, a 10th grader at a public school in Arcata. And at her other daughter's high school graduation, Finnan and that daughter were part of a group that wore keffiyehs, which is a symbol of support for Palestinians. It's like a scarf. The police department received a report of disruption at the graduation because of the wearing of these keffiyehs. According to the lawsuit, the group had peacefully and lawfully exercised their right to show solidarity with the Palestinian people during a genocide. A GF would like to learn about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, not just from the Israeli perspective, but the Palestinian one as well. And he would like to give presentations similar to the one his sister gave last year. But Alice Finnan fears that GF won't be able to give such presentations because it could be considered critical of Israel and thus hostile to Jewish students, subjecting the teacher to discipline.
This is Jim Lafferty. I'm here without my normal co-host, Michael Smith, today, and I'm talking with our guest, Marjorie Cohn, about a new law in California being contested by parents and students because of what it does to teachers in the classroom if they teach certain subjects in certain ways. Now, Marjorie Cohn, what are the plaintiffs in this lawsuit actually asking the court to do?
Well, before I answer that, Jim, I just want to add that this new law empowers anyone to anonymously file a complaint claiming that classroom content and instructional materials are critical of Israel and therefore anti-Semitic. And the new law provides for the appointment of an anti-Semitism prevention coordinator, whose job it is to review the curriculum and threaten school districts with fines and teacher dismissals for refusing to discontinue the dissemination of material considered, quote, factually inaccurate.
And the plaintiff in the lawsuit, they're asking the court to do what then?
They are asking the federal court for what is called declaratory relief. The plaintiffs want the federal court to declare that the AB 715 amendments to the California Education Code violate the teacher plaintiff's rights to due process under the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution because they are unconstitutionally vague. The lawsuit also seeks a declaration from the court that the amendments violate the teacher plaintiff's rights under the First Amendment because they are overbroad and viewpoint discriminatory. And finally, under declaratory relief, the lawsuit requests that the court issue a declaration that the amendments violate the student plaintiff's rights under the First Amendment because they are overbroad and viewpoint discriminatory. So that same they want that same declaration vis-a-vis the teacher plaintiffs and the teacher students. And then the lawsuit is also seeking an injunction to prevent the defendants from enforcing the AB 715 amendments.
I wonder, Marjorie, are any other states having similar laws or facing pressure and lobbying to have a similar law to the one we've been discussing today?
Jim, my understanding is that they are, and I can't tell you specifics right now, but I understand that this is not unique to California.
I think in the course of answering the questions, you may have already touched on this, but let's be clear, why does the contention of these plaintiffs, and I gather your contention as well, that simply being critical of Zionism is not discriminatory towards the Jewish race or the Jewish religion?
That's true, Jim. This is censorship, bald-faced censorship. And for people who want to understand the difference between Judaism and Zionism, I would refer you to a collection called Reclaiming Judaism from Zionism, Stories of Personal Transformation. It's a group of essays from activists, writers, students, rabbis, who have rejected Zionism but feel very close to their Judaism. I actually have an essay in this book. And one of the very interesting things about this collection, Reclaiming Judaism from Zionism, which is edited by Carolyn Karcher, is the introduction and the afterword that contain a very interesting and informative history of how Zionism developed and what it is. So I strongly urge the listeners to pick up that book because I think it would be very, very useful to them.
Yes, indeed. I'm thinking of the fact that when the State of Israel was being formed, those who were forming the State of Israel approached prominent Jewish leaders and thinkers in the world to be the head of this new country, including Albert Einstein, who said under no circumstances would he be the head of a country that was Zionist because of the discriminatory nature of that for the other citizens in that country. Is that not the case?
Yes, that is the case, and good for Albert Einstein. He was wise on many levels.
Marjorie, I'm sorry, but that is all the time we have today for this topic. Where can our listeners follow your work, perhaps learn more about the topic and more about your writings?
Well, Jim, I write a regular column for truthout.org. So if you go to the homepage of Truthout, go down to the bottom, my column is called Human Rights and Global Wrongs. Many of my pieces are collected there. I also write for Sheer Post and Consortium News and other outlets, but all of my articles and other work are collected at my website, marjoriecohn.com.
Well, excellent. Well, we thank you so much, Marjorie Cohn, for joining us today here on Law and Disorder. And we wish you all the success in your future work.
Thanks so much, Jim.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org, and there you'll learn ways to pledge your support for the show, and we appreciate that as well.